This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
You are listening to Red Ice Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for tuning in. Please go to RedIceCreations.com for much more. Today we're talking to Courtney Brown. He is a mathematician and social scientist who teaches in the Department of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Independent of his work at the university, he is also the leading scholar on the subject of remote viewing, as it is done using procedures that were developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes, or procedures that are derivative of those methodologies. Dr. Brown is the director and founder of the Farsight Institute, a nonprofit research and educational organization dedicated to the study of phenomenon of non-local consciousness, also known as remote viewing. His recent published book on the subject, Remote Viewing, the Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception, is the only book of its kind where the science of remote viewing is developed with respect to highly structured data collection methodologies. In this new book, he analyzes data and develops a new theory that explains the remote viewing phenomenon as a consequence of superposition formation on the quantum level. He is with us today to discuss remote viewing and to share data from remote viewing sessions in relation to 2012 and huge planetary changes. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Courtney Brown. This is going to be very interesting. You're making quite a bit of waves, if I can put it that way, in the alternative research movement here. This we have so much to talk about, Courtney. But first of all, then, welcome to the program. Great of you to take some time off to speak with us here today.
Henrik, I'm so pleased that you invited me to be on Red Ice Radio, and it's my honor, so thank you.
Very good. Now, of course, we need to touch on some of the background here in the beginning to kind of set the framework. We're going to get into some interesting stuff here later on about that, but I think it would also be interesting to hear a little bit about the field of remote viewing. We have this is a back, issue for us. We've been interested in remote viewing, but actually we've done very few programs on the subject. So why don't you spend a little bit of time introducing yourself and also then talk about remote viewing overall, how it functions and so forth, so we'll kind of set the scene with that, if you will.
Sure, that's a great way to start out. So I'm Courtney Brown, and I have a variety of hats. So I am the lead, without any doubt, the primary scholar, academic, that studies the subject of remote viewing as it is done using procedures that were developed by the United States military and used operationally for espionage purposes or methodologies that are derivative of those procedures. I can say unambiguously that I am the leading scholar because I am the only scholar that studies this particular realm, this particular aspect of remote viewing, which is the most important aspect of remote viewing, where remote viewing is done using people who are highly trained in these methodologies, which I'll explain a little bit more later. However, I'm also a university professor, but I do not do remote viewing research at my university. At Emory University in Atlanta, I teach mostly mathematics courses, and I'm an applied mathematician in a social science program. So I teach the statistics and nonlinear differential equation modeling, which is my specialty, things like that at the university. But my remote viewing research is done at the Farsight Institute. That's farsight.org. Farsight is like the word seeing far, and then the word sight, like seeing, .org. And it is the premier science venue for the study of remote viewing as it is done using these military or military-derived procedures. So we have a large number of publications. We have a recent publication, for example, in a leading scientific, mainstream scientific journal that's peer-reviewed. On the subject of remote viewing, And you can see that article, for example, it's a link to it is on our website, farsight.org, right on the home page. I have also done a book, and the people I work with, I'm the chief investigator. I was also trained, I also am a remote viewer, so I'm one of those rare scientists that actually learns the stuff that they're investigating. Normally scientists look at things at a distance, so scientists normally are not remote viewers when they ask remote viewers to do stuff. And that has caused lots of problems in the past. But I am actually a remote viewer. So when I design studies that other remote viewers participate in, I design them with the knowledge of the remote viewing process and as I have experienced it. So I have added that element to it. So the remote viewing process, the basic thing that I should sort of introduce to your listeners, is a mental procedure. And in the old days, people might have called it psychic stuff, but we don't use that anymore because it's really much different, much better, much bigger. But it is a mental procedure that has people in the normal waking state of consciousness, just like you and I are now, do these procedures in order to perceive things, images of people, places, events, that are distant from the remote viewer in time and space. So they can be from the past, they can be from the present, or even from the future. And so it enables the remote viewer to transfer perceptions or information from the past, present, or future, anywhere in time and space, to the present, where the remote viewer records that information. It's very important to understand that remote viewing is done totally blind. It cannot be done without that condition. That means that the remote viewer has absolutely no prior knowledge of what they're supposed to be perceiving. They just literally take a stack of paper and a pen and go into a room. In ideal situations, it's a room that doesn't have much in it, just a table that's in the center of the room, facing diagonally towards a corner, so they're not flat up against the wall. And if there's any recording equipment, that's behind them. The colors are ideally very neutral.
No distractions, in other words.
No distractions, no pictures, things like that, if it's under ideal circumstances. And then they sit down, and an hour later, they go through the procedures, an hour later, come up with a detailed description of, with lots of details, of the thing that they're supposed to perceive. And that thing is called a target. Now, the target can be anything. However, the remote viewer doesn't know what that is. They just go into a room being told that there's a target, that's it, nothing more. And they go in and describe it. Now, the target is the thing that they're supposed to perceive. So a target could be, for example, the Battle of Gettysburg, or it could be Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo, or it could be a space shuttle launch, or it could be the International Space Station at a certain time or date, or it could be anything that you can think of, President Obama giving a speech. So what it is that the remote viewers can describe what that thing is without knowing in advance consciously what that thing is. And we do now understand the science behind why it actually works. And I've given many presentations recently about that. And actually, I've spoken at prestigious venues, including major universities all over the United States and prestigious venues in Europe, including to a group of Nobels in Zurich, physicists. So it's really come of age in the early days.
How is that perceived, by the way, Courtney, by this audience, the subject?
By the academic audience?
Yes.
The academic audience 15 years ago was simply laughing, and they called me deluded. No one's laughing anymore. There's not a single person on the planet Earth that's laughing. No one's saying deluded anymore. Do you know there's a movie called Waiting to Exhale? That's what it's like. It has like Whitney Houston in it and some others. it's like the whole academy is like holding their breath, waiting to exhale because they're saying, oh my gosh. You know, the thing is, you should never bet against an intelligent and persistent academic who never backs down. never bet against a Galileo, against a Newton, somebody who never backs down. You never bet against them because they're almost always right if they never back down. Because if they never back down, they know internally that they are right. Mm-hmm, and that's why they never back down.
And they will pursue to the end of the world.
And the academic community seems to have gotten to that level where they're saying, OMG, this looks like it might be one of those situations. So they used to laugh. No one's laughing anymore, but they're not embracing it yet. They're holding their breath and remaining silent. And it's like I'm in a football game where I'm playing football, but there's no opposing team and the field has been cleared and I'm free to run down and make a goal. That's what it's like. Whereas in the early days, I was the only person on one team, and the opposing team had 100,000 members, and they were clogging the whole field, and it was hard for me to make any headway. Now that the whole field is cleared, everybody's in the stand. You can hear a pin drop in the audience, and I've got a clear path to the goal. So it's fascinating. Now, the other side of that question is, why aren't the other academics doing this type of research? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That will come. But for right now, I'm in that delicious moment when they're realizing something's there and they're holding their breath and wondering if it will go away. But they're not laughing anymore.
But sorry to interrupt that, Courtney, but we have to...
Yeah,
what these academics don't have in mind as well is the history of the field in the background of U.S. military, 1st Earth Battalion. There's a number of people investigated into this field, a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money as well. So, and that's also where you kind of come out from, correct?
Yeah, well, I was never in the military, but I did learn the procedures. And I work with people like Glenn Wheaton, who was in the 1st Earth Battalion, and Lynn Buchanan. Glenn Wheaton runs he's head of Special Forces Intelligence, and he runs the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild. And Lynn Buchanan came out of Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA. Both are out of the Army. And he is the premier trainer in the CRV methodology. Now, controlled remote viewing, or CRV methodology, has its intuitive genius originator as Ingo Swann, an artist who was able to develop that, and that's what the DIA used in their official program. And in the unofficial movement within Special Forces that later became known as the 1st Earth Battalion, the intuitive genius was Dr. Richard Ireland. So we have two different sets of procedures that came out of that. So, and this 1st Earth Battalion was not an official program. It was a movement within the military. But nonetheless, they did remote viewing, and that's where the HRVG, or Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild, stuff comes out of.
And they get funding from the military to do this, right?
Well, their official funding as a program was only done with the DIA's program. Mm-hmm. Unofficially, as a movement, lots of things go on in the military, and that's where the 1st Earth Battalion came about. But the that wasn't an official program. Nonetheless, you know, I'm not an ex-military person, so I leave it up to the military people to talk about the history. And some of them do get a little upset when I do talk a little bit about it, because they want that stage themselves. And I grant it to them, let them talk about it.
Right.
I'm a scientist. I'm an academic. I did serve my country. I was a Peace Corps volunteer. But that's a little different. I am the leading scholar. Whether or not I was in the military or not, I'm still the leading scholar in the use of these procedures for scientific studies. And Lynn Buchanan and Glenn Wheaton, for example, are on the board of directors for the Far Sight Institute. And so they have considerable sway over what I do many cases.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a science shop that does this. And we're the only venue anywhere that has these enormous numbers of studies studying the nature of physical reality, the nature of the remote viewing phenomenon itself, and then the uses of remote viewing to study particular things. Let me be honest with you, Henrik. We have so much on our website that we used to just give out everything just for free, but it gets to be a point where we're doing these study after study after study using these people, these remote viewers. There's fewer than 20 of them on the planet who are trained in like over 10 years in the use of these procedures, and they're really military grade or better. They're really the best you can get on the planet. And people come to our website and it's very often are overwhelmed, meaning they start, where do you start? And like, we've been doing this thing for so long, we just kept accumulating these studies, and people sort of said, you know, where do I start with this thing? So everything was up there for free, and videos of presentations and prestigious venues was up there. Everything was there. We even have an audio course in the use of a type of remote viewing that's derivative of the military that I developed called SRV, Scientific Remote Viewing, and that's hosted by YouTube. It's free. It's 18 hours, 24 lessons, plus a printable text. So we have so much up there in terms of these studies that people were, people just didn't know where to start. So what we did is we decided to change a little bit, and we actually came out with a DVD. I'm a college professor, and a lot of my students don't read anymore. I mean, students in around the world are so internet-oriented and visual-oriented. So we decided that, you know, I have a book and I have published articles. I have multiple books. I'm remote viewing. I've got 4 books. But we decided that, you know, we need a visual thing. So we have a DVD. It's called The Far Sight Experiments. And the link for it, which is a really attractive graphic for the cover design that was developed by Daz Smith, one of the great remote viewers, not a military remote viewer, but one of the new generation remote viewers, lives in Britain. He's also a graphics artist, and he has a really nice cover design for the DVD. Anyway, with a head and light coming out of it. Anyway, the link for that DVD is right on our homepage of the website, and it's distributed worldwide through Amazon. And the Far Sight Experiment summarizes most of the major projects that we have done up through 2011. And it is an ability for people to, in one sitting, sit down and find out, you know, where we are, what we do, and hit the ground running, and then being able to say, okay, I know everything you do. For example, the projects that are on there and all tied together nicely in a nice explanatory way are things like the Multiple Universes Project, which is actually the experiment that we had published in the leading journal of scientific, peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Scientific Exploration. The Multiple Universes Project was an actual explicit test to see something that has been around, talked about for, you know, since the early 1900s, in the realm of quantum mechanics. And it was really brought to the forefront in 1957 by Hugh Everett, but then sort of who did his dissertation in 1957, under John Wheeler in Princeton. But then it sort of died away, and now it's starting to come back. And that's the idea that there are multiple realities, that there are many versions of all of us. For example, there's a version of me where I'm speaking right now with a white shirt and a bandana on my head. But there's another version of reality that is just as real as this one, where I don't have the bandana, or I have a blue shirt, or another version where you're interviewing someone else, not me, and it goes on and on and on, an infinite variety of realities. Now, on the quantum level, this has always been known, and mainstream quantum physicists traditionally, since the early 1900s, followed the Copenhagen interpretation, which is that only one reality snaps out of that multiple possible realm and all the others disappear. The development came out in 1957 with Hugh Everett's dissertation was that that was garbage. And you cannot say that everything disappears and one comes. That was more of a theological proposition than anything, because they really wanted to say we're unique. And God created us just like the early, you know, people wanted to say where Earth is the center of the universe and everything surrounds us. Well, you know, the unbeknownst to them, without really realizing psychologically, the early quantum mechanics people were really wanting to say we're unique. And if you say that we're not unique, and in fact there's an infinite variety of us, then that's a problem. Then we're not. Anyway, so they had a psychological hurdle. But Hugh Everett came along with that, that's a monstrosity, and came up with an alternative view, an alternative interpretation of quantum mechanics. He wasn't challenging the calculations that quantum mechanics people do. They're really good with calculating. But the interpretation of what they're doing when they're doing the calculating. And he said basically that there are all of these multiple realities and that they don't disappear. And he was also willing to generalize the quantum mechanics so that things that happen on the quantum level, well, mainstream physicists traditionally have said it's sort of like Las Vegas. Whatever happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. But whatever happens in the quantum level stays in the quantum level. And the macro level or the classical realm, the one that we live in, is different. And they have an imaginary line of decoherence that separates the small from the large. Mm-hmm. And Hugh Everett said, that's ridiculous. And even people like Roger Penrose have acknowledged that this charade can't go on forever because the entire macro world is based on the quantum stuff. So you can't just say it goes away. And so what Hugh Everett did was came up with the theoretical justification, and his mathematics are really solid. Fortunately, I am a mathematician, so I really enjoy the mathematical side of all of this. So, but he came up with an interpretation that said that it's not just that the multiple reality issue occurs only on the quantum level, but it scales out. So what happens on the quantum level, a particle scales out to the atom when the particles are combined. And that scales out to the molecule when the molecule has a bunch of atoms. And that scales out to the cell, which scales out to the person, which scales out to the house you're in, which scales out to the earth. And in fact, there is what they call a universal wave function, meaning there's a whole variety of different universes. So he called that the other worlds. I actually used words like relative state, but that was a little difficult for mainstream to sort of grasp, sort of general people to grasp. So I like to call it with the sort of more catchy terms of other worlds or multiple realities. But basically we did an explicit test on the multiple universe idea and it corroborated it exactly. And to give you an idea of how we go about these things and why the scientific experiments that we do involve so much work, they're not like just simple things. The design for that one was really simple. When we remote view into the past, it's always easy to locate the target. For example, if you want to have the remote view the sinking of the Titanic, well, in our time stream, we know the Titanic sunk, so we know exactly what we want the remote viewer to go to, and they do that. But if you're remote viewing the future, it never works easily. And we knew that time didn't exist, that it was an illusion. So I don't think we're going to have time for me to go into why that's the case. But nonetheless, we had long concluded that time is an illusion. But we couldn't figure out why we could remote view the past easily, but not remote view the future. And some people say, well, it just hasn't happened yet. But that's not a reality. The reality is the future, the past, and the present all occur simultaneously. Why can we not remote view the future so easily? And the test was, if there are multiple universes, when you remote view the past, you're picking something that you know out of a multiple reality situation for the past. So you're selecting it. But in the future, you don't know what you're selecting. So you can pick anything out of the future. And it can be real. It just is not the future that you're going to get. So I came up with a different design to put these remote viewers through, which really, now, excuse me, when I mention it, you're going to have to go to a chiropractor after this because it's going to twist your neck. So it's going to twist your head around. But this is what we did. In order to remote view of the future. The idea was we had to have somebody in the future who experienced a single time stream. If there are multiple realities, multiple futures, you've got to select one out. Well, the person who picks the target is called the tasker. He's the person, or she's the person, that decides what the remote viewer is supposed to look at. Mm-hmm. So what we did the following. We broke it up into a three-month sequence. Now, this is where your head gets twisted around. The remote viewing sessions done with like 9, 10, 12 of the best remote viewers on the planet Earth occurred in, say, the month of January. Okay? There is no target. They just did the sessions. No one had picked a target. They just did sessions. They went into the rooms, did a session. That was it. Now, the second month. The second month was a month of February where some event would occur and that event would be the target. It wasn't chosen, but it was going to happen in February. Mind you, the sessions were already done. Now, at the end of January, we took the sessions, encrypted them in 256 military-grade encryption, put them up on our website, and literally tens of thousands of people all over the world downloaded them so that they could verify that we didn't cheat. So we've really mastered the realm of public participation in our experiments. Mm-hmm. We don't like the idea of saying, I did this in my laboratory, trust me. The words trust me should be eliminated with regard to scientific stuff. So at the end of January, tens of thousands of people had downloaded these sessions. Then we wait for the month of February for some event to occur. Now, in the month of March, before we even started the experiment in January, somebody had agreed that when March rolls around, a specific person, they would pick some event that happens in the world in February.
Although they don't know it yet.
They don't know it yet, but they just agreed when March rolls around, they'll look at everything that happened in mm-hmm. the news mm-hmm. in February. The only requirement was it has to be a major thing that you can verify. So it has to be like some news story that other people can say that it, so they can know for in fact it actually did happen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be on the Earth. It can be, for example, the La Crosse NASA mission of throwing a satellite.
Projectile on the moon there, yeah.
Projectile into the moon mm-hmm. to see if they can kick up some ice. That was one of the targets. But most of the other targets were just targets on Earth. Everything from a Macy's Day Parade in New York City to the landing of a space shuttle, things like that.
Right.
So a hurricane that went through a tornado that ripped through Mino, Arkansas in the United States. So those are the types of targets. And so what would happen is the sessions were done in January. The target would occur sometime in February, but no one would know what it is. And then in March, the assigned person would look over all the news stories in February and say, I wonder what I'm going to assign these viewers to do. Mind you, the sessions were already done. And he's thinking in March what he's going to assign them to do. And so in March, he picks the target out of something that happens in February and then tells us what it is. We post it on the website. And then post the password to decrypt a session so people can then look at the sessions. And for one solid year in a rolling fashion, a whole year, that's 11 demonstrations, we hit it every time. I mean, it was perfect.
Really?
Every single target was perfectly described. And that proved the case because that was an a priori prediction. We had a theory, multiple reality theory, and that if you have a temporal outbounder, you're going to be able to lift a single time stream out of the mix. Because for that temporal outbounder, that person in the future who's cooperating with the study, that event is in the past. It actually happened. So it doesn't matter when you do the sessions. The sessions can be done before the event occurs and before the event is even chosen as the target. It doesn't, as long as you keep everything secret, so that people, you know, so the tasker doesn't know what the remote viewing sessions look like. Mm-hmm. As long as everything's controlled, it doesn't matter when you do it. So anyway, really was a very successful, and that was a multiple universe project, mm-hmm, for example. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you there. I think I get the idea. It's quite a head twister, but I think I get it. In March there then, if we do the equivalent of the tests you've done consequently, does that mean that those who look at stuff in March and what happened in February, if we use that analogy, do they always have to do that for this whole cycle to be completed? Meaning,
well,
if you look, yeah, go ahead.
Meaning, to predict the future, do you have to have somebody in the future to cooperate with you?
Eventually, yeah, well, for the event to be hit.
Okay, in a multiple reality context, this means that it is absolutely impossible to simply say, I'm going to predict the future. Because if you have multiple realities, the only way you can describe the future is if you do have somebody in the future cooperating. And that means when the remote viewing sessions are done, you don't know what they're describing.
Right.
You literally have to wait until the person makes a target, and then you can compare. So you have a description of the future, but you don't know what you're describing.
Right. Yeah.
Until the target's been identified. So that's a problem. However, we have another study that's also on the DVD called the 2012 Climate Project. Now, that was originally a project that was looking at what we expected to be minor climate change between June 1st, 2008 and June 1st, 2013, 5-year span. And we were expecting to find maybe an inch rise in sea level, maybe a few more storms, maybe a little less snow on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. And we were trying to see if remote viewing could be sensitive enough to detect that type of stuff. Well, that was what we started with. But what we got was, and we had a really squeaky clean scientific design with perfect randomization. We had the best remote viewers on the planet, and we had over 100 remote viewing sessions. It was the largest collection of remote viewing data using these types of procedures ever done before, using the best remote viewers. I decided to, in regard to the 2013 stuff, since there are multiple realities, I decided to see if we could describe the future if we identified in advance characteristics of two time streams for the future. So rather than have a temporal outbounder or somebody in the future cooperating to pick the target, I said, okay, let's describe June 1st in like 8 different places all over the globe, 2013, but let's describe it under the conditions in which X, Y, and Z happens. And now let's describe it under the conditions in which A, B, and C happens along the way. So what we tried to do with this experiment is to see if specifying characteristics of the timeline would work. So neither timeline would be our exact timeline, but because we don't have a temporal outbounder, someone picking the targets in the future for us. But we do say, but we are hoping we're able to say, there is one future where these things happen and another future where these things happen. And under those two different futures, this is what it looks like. And hopefully we can then say, then our future is a little closer to this, to, you know, version A, or our future is a little closer to version B. Mm-hmm. And that way we can determine it. Now, what we found, to our great surprise, and no one was more surprised than me, was that, let me first state that I didn't believe the Mayan calendar thing at all. I thought it was a piece of junk. I thought it was just garbage. I just thought it was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. And when we got the results back, I had to say, oops, sorry. We found these huge Earth changes. I mean, huge. I mean, like right off the scale. And it was a clear binary result, meaning everything was randomized. Then the remote viewers knew nothing about what the targets were. And they knew there was no possible way any one of them would have known whether they were doing a session for the 2008 targets or 2013 targets. Mm-hmm. And what we got when it was all done, was all analyzed, is there was a binary result. The 2008 targets, all those sessions didn't describe any disaster type of content, meaning a lot of the targets were near sea level, including Washington, D.C., but also Tuvalu, in an island in the South Pacific, you know, Mali International Airport in the Maldives, Fort Jesus, an old Portuguese fort on the, in the city of Mombasa on the coast of Indian Ocean, Sydney, Australia, the Opera House. So a lot of the targets were on the coast. And what we found is that in 2008, everything was normal. People were still going to the beaches. The tourists were happy. Everything was fine. And for the 2013 sessions, both timelines, remember we had two separate timelines we were trying to look at, they had horrific, huge planetary changes. I can describe those later on in the program if you want, but it was, it was a huge result. I mean, it wasn't an inch of sea level or a little bit more storms. We had just, I mean, complete wipeout type disaster stuff. Washington, D.C. didn't look like Washington, D.C. anymore. I mean, it was, you know, Hawaii didn't look like Hawaii anymore in terms of the main island of Oahu. So, I mean, it was just one thing after the next, tsunamis, things like meteors coming. And I can detail some of that information for you if you want
sure,
later.
Sure. When did you do this then? How far back are we? 2007 then or 6 or earlier?
The two targets for the two time periods are 2008 and 2013.
And they were done when?
They were done in the first half of 2008 because the targets were... The sessions were all done, most of them much earlier than May 2008, but by May 2008, everything was up.
Okay.
People were downloading them in encrypted form all over the world. And we had a randomization process that used the Dow Jones Industrial Average number for June 4th, 2008. To randomize which sessions would be associated with which target. So it was impossible for anyone, including me, to know which session would be describing which target until after all the sessions were up.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the randomization process occurred and we knew what sessions were describing what targets, we looked at them, and it was one of those OMG moments, oh my God, you know, moments. It was like, I was expecting to see if little snow was different on Mount Kilimanjaro, and whoa, what a change. So Mount Kilimanjaro was still there, but in terms of the other cities, big stuff. Anyway, so that's another project. I call that the 2012 Climate Project, and that's also on the DVD. In addition, on the DVD called the Farsight Experiments. And another project on that DVD is an operational base on Mars. We actually found a facility, a technological facility, that has a really clear NASA JPL Malin Space Science Systems image with a nozzle, looks like a long pipe, with a very strong spray coming out of it. So we found out later it's a refuse spray. And there's a shadow underneath it. I mean, it's a very, very high resolution, very clear. And the nozzle is connected to a pipeline which goes into a dome. And there's like three domes next to it and a really large dome nearby made of shiny materials, looks like a resin. Anyway, so we looked at that and the spray really caught my attention. I said, okay, let's have the remote viewers do that. So under totally blind conditions, they were tasked with that whole facility. And they came back and exactly described it. They described the spray, the nozzle, the pipeline, the domes. And then once they saw the domes by themselves, they just went into the domes. So we found out what was going on there, who was there, what they were doing. So that's another project we did. And we also did another project on a planet that exploded between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, a planet we now call Maldek. And there is a tremendous amount of planetary data that supports the idea that there was a planet between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter that exploded, leaving the asteroid belt. And that planetary data was summarized and collected by Thomas van Flandern, a very mainstream astronomer, the late Thomas van Flandern. He was the head of his Department of Celestial Mechanics at the Naval Observatory here in the U.S., and mainstream astronomers like him, but other mainstream astronomers widely scoffed at the idea because they didn't want to acknowledge the idea that a planet could explode. They always said stars could explode like a supernova, but a planet, they didn't want to go there. But you know, the reality is they've never seen a star explode. All they see is a bright light in the sky. They never had a space probe out there to see if it was a planet exploding near a star or if it was the star itself. They don't know what it is. They just see a bright light and they assume that only stars can explode. Well, in this case, the evidence is overwhelmingly clear on the planetary data that the mainstream idea that the asteroid built was created out of the refuse that was left over from the primordial solar nebula when the planets were forming is just wrong. The planetary data say it's wrong, and we did a remote viewing study to test whether the solar nebula hypothesis or the exploding planet hypothesis was correct, and Thomas Van Flandern was totally correct. There was a planet and it exploded. So that's the other type of project we did. And so you get the idea of the wide diversity of the types of stuff we do. We decided to collect that into a very easily understandable DVD, The Farsight Experiments. And so I really recommend for people that want to sort of hit the ground running, know what we do, just start with the DVD. It's easier. And you really get the full shock of how far we've gone with this thing. And then the website is much more accessible. And my other written work, my book, The Remote Viewing, The Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception, is more easily accessible because they can then say, okay, now I understand what you guys are doing. So then they can dive into the book and so on. But the that's the type of stuff we do, which mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. really, really, really advanced. It's not yet taught on the university level, but that's typical. Remember, it wasn't until the 1930s that somebody taught the first course in gravity. I believe it was in Princeton, and they had to apply to request permission to teach a course on gravity.
Interesting.
There's a time and place for all of these things, and we're getting to the point where in a few years' time, remote viewing will be taught as an academic subject in many universities.
Interesting.
But for right now, this is the place you get it.
Now, obviously, these are all of the events you mentioned are huge subjects in themselves, and I think we'd do good in actually holding off on some of the latter ones and focus on the post 2012 stuff for now. I mean, we've been interested in the planet, the exploding planet, the planet hypothesis for a long time. MetaResearch.org, Tom and Flannery's website, really fascinating stuff. Same thing with the Mars, of course, and maybe at another time, Courtney, if you don't mind. But so let's go back again then to the initial tests or experiments that you did on June 1st, 2008 and June 1st, 2013. And maybe you can just give us a little bit of some of the details of what you found and how and when in the timeline and everything else there.
Okay, well, first let's look at where we looked. So I guess you have a general idea of what we did in the experiment, which is in the first half of 2008, we had a large group of remote viewers, the best on the planet, trained typically a decade or more in these military or military-derived procedures under people like Glenn Wheaton and Lynn Buchanan. And they remote viewed targets that they, of course, did under totally blind conditions. They didn't know what they were looking at. They did the remote viewing sessions for that. And each target is 10, 15 pages, up to 20 pages of detailed data for each one of these targets. And these remote viewing sessions are not, these are trained people. So these are not like vague and ambiguous type of sessions. These are very detailed sessions where you can clearly see what's going on. It's like playing the piano. Anybody can go up to the piano and bang on it and make noise. But if you're going to play in Carnegie Hall like Lang Lang, you have to practice and be good at it. Well, these are those types of peoples. And so when you hear Lang Lang play the piano, you clearly hear a melody. You clearly hear the tone and tenor and the whole stuff that he's doing. So these people with remote viewing are like that. So when they describe a target, it's not ambiguous in their results what they're describing. So the targets that we assigned them were the Vaitupu Tuvalu, that's an island in the South Pacific, and that's, you know, a couple feet above sea level, sometimes even less. So that looked like a good place to look to see if there's going to be any Earth-type changes in terms of. Then Fort Jesus, Mombasa, that Portuguese fort in the city of Mombasa, right on the coast of Kenya, Indian Ocean. And then the Sydney Opera House in Sydney, Australia, that has that very unique architecture. So that was a good target because not only was it right on the coast, but it has a clear architecture, so people would be able to see that the remote viewers are unambiguously describing that target, because they would be just, you know, drawing that very unique shape. Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. I was interested if the snow might change a little bit over those 5-year period. The United States Congress building is actually only 90 feet above sea level, very close to the coast, so that was another idea, another target. Mali International Airport in the Maldives, right on sea level. And the KITV building in Honolulu, Hawaii. KITV is actually a television broadcasting station that one of our remote viewers works at as a celebrity newscaster, Dick Allgaier. And so it was an interesting thing for me to put that in. And that was very interesting. I'll describe the sessions he got back for his own workplace in Honolulu. And then we also had the Vehicle Assembly Building at Launch Complex 39 in the Kennedy Space Center, Merritt Island, Florida, and also Key West in Florida. So those are the targets, and the remote viewers did sessions for those targets, and we got back results. Now, I guess it might be useful to cut to the chase and sort of summarize the results before I go into specific things that you may want me to talk about.
Right. Well, I have so many questions, of course, but I just want to let you have the floor and lay it out for us so we can understand what we're talking about here.
Sure. Well, in general, so I'm not now talking about any particular place. We can do that later. But in general, what the remote viewing data suggested, and again, mind you, there was no disaster content in the 2008 sessions. It only happened in the 2013 sessions, and that was the surprise. So there was perfect scientific controls so that the viewers would never know whether they were doing a 2008 or 2013 session. There was perfect randomization. And so the fact that it all piled up in 2013 was a real eye-opener. What we saw in the 2013 sessions, none of which occurred in the 2008 sessions, was impacts of all things from what appear to be large meteors leading to tsunamis and even possible volcanism. That was really surprising, and I'll get into details some of those things later. We also had extensive and forceful flooding of coastal areas. We had excessive solar radiation and storms and other severe weather. Okay, and now in terms of the effects that it had on humans, what we found was there was a massive self-organized relocation from coastal areas. We're talking refugees. And when I say self-organized, it's like we're not having the government doing it. It's people doing it, people just moving. And we had the complete breakdown of rescue or other notable governmental functioning. So you don't have the National Guard or the military coming in with choppers and jeeps and stuff like that. That just was gone. You had the breakdown of the food supply system. People were foraging. They weren't going to the local grocery store. And the complete breakdown of the vehicular transport system. People were hoofing it. They were walking. And extensive loss of buildings near the coasts. Now, there's a problem with the data in that we were looking for climate change originally, so we picked a lot of coastal targets. We didn't pick a lot of targets that were inland. So the fact that we found extensive loss of buildings near the coasts is a bit of a problem because that's where we were looking. So we really don't know what was going on far inland. But nonetheless, it was very interesting to see what was going along, what was happening during the coast.
Maybe you can describe something for us here. When a remote viewer is honing in on this, is it like do they see a snapshot, if you will, if we can compare it to a photograph, or is it like a movie playing for a short while? And if so, how far in time does that actually go?
Well, the remote viewing images are best described this way. You're looking right now, probably, since we're doing this interview over Skype, you're looking probably at your computer. It has a bright screen and so on like that. Many people listening to the show or this are looking at a radio in a room or maybe on a computer. Well, those images that are going in through the eye are very bright images that are being picked up by the ocular mechanism and transmitted to the brain and so on. Okay, now with your eyes open, as you're looking at your computer or whatever you're looking at, imagine a pencil and bring the memory of the pencil up in front of you. So you see the yellow pencil, the eraser at one end and the sharp tip at the other. Perhaps you'll see an Eberhard label on the pencil with the number 2 on it. And notice that that image of the pencil, which is coming from your memory, is dimmer than a little dimmer than the image that's coming in through the eyes. It's like overlaid on top of the image coming in through the eyes, but it's a little dimmer. Well, the remote viewing images are like that. They are foggier, fuzzier, dimmer than the memory images. So remote viewers are trained to pay attention to these other things that are actually existing in everybody's life, but we ignore them. Our brains screen them out. So the remote viewers are trained to not screen them out, but to observe them. And so we're dealing with relatively foggy, fuzzy images, some of which are and when remote viewers get really good at it, some of their images are exceptionally clear, but they're really good at sort of piecing it all together. Now, when remote viewers go to a target and they start perceiving these things, their job is to sort through these foggier, fuzzier images until they eventually get some things that are clearer. You can think of it like you're listening to two things at the same time. Let's say you're watching the TV and your friend has the radio on at the same time. So you're hearing two things at the same time. Well, if you focus and really concentrate, you sort of can screen out the radio while you're listening to the TV. You sort of focus on that one thing. So that's what the remote viewers do. They end up focusing on the remote viewing stuff till they can really get it clearly. And then once they start perceiving what's there at the target, they typically widen the lens. So they start with describing just sort of basic things that they see at the target. But then they start seeing things change. And so they start describing change. And then if they see something happening at a target, for example, they'll see a lot of coastal damage, their normal reaction is to say, wow, what caused this? And then they back up in time to see the process that caused that. So they end up with 10 to 20 pages of paper that describe the physical, that contain the physical descriptions of the target or the place, plus information relating to why that target looks the way it looks, mm-hmm. what happened to it. Mm-hmm. So it's a process, it's a learned process of gathering information, sort of saying this is odd, posing questions, then going to answer those questions, backing up, looking around, turning around. So it's not like a movie where you have everything presented to you from beginning to end in a clear plot. But all of the information that you'd get in a movie is non-linearly collected. So you don't get the beginning, the middle, and the end in the proper order. Mm-hmm, right. But you get it all there, and then they tie it all together. And then by the end of the session, they usually put it in the proper order, but it's collected in a non-linear fashion. Does that make sense?
It sure does. And then the art, of course, in that is to weave this together in a coherent picture without, and I guess this is also the watermark here, then what separates a good from a bad remote viewer of not bringing too much of your own imagination into this, but actually objectively just seeing what's there, putting it all together and down on the paper, correct?
That's what the training is all about. That's why they go through the training, to be able to do that. And that's why just anyone off the street can't do that.
Yeah.
Because it's such an involved procedure to piece everything together and control the flow of the information such that the larger picture makes sense.
Absolutely. And also incorporating into that question, let's say that the target was, and I mean, it might be absurd here, but it instead was the shoelace of a person going by the Sydney Opera House. You know what I mean? What is the ability here for the person to be able to zoom out, and how much can they zoom out and look around?
That's a good example. Let me actually use that example to give you some of the limitations of remote viewing. That target would be considered, say the shoelace of someone, would be considered an embedded target. And we don't allow embedded targets because remote viewers usually don't succeed in describing them. And what that means is it's just a small thing embedded in a large scene. For example, let's say the target, and this was an example of something that was used by someone who was studying remote viewing, and it would just turned out to be just a stupid thing to do, but it was what happened.
Right.
The target was a flower pot in someone's kitchen. Had a pot and a flower. And the person said, that seems like a reasonable thing. And so what happens is the viewers went, these trained remote viewers were assigned under blind conditions that target. And they went in and described perfectly the house, the unique architecture that was inside and outside of the house, the neighborhood, the way the roads were, the whole thing. But they missed the flower pot. So, you know, the researcher scored them as a miss. And that was a classic case of researchers just not understanding the remote viewing process. So that flower pot was an embedded target. See, the remote viewers take their consciousness and they go to the place, but there's no guarantee of what they'll actually see. They're going to see whatever they see. Now, it's exactly the same as you physically going into a room. Now, let's say I take you, Henrik, and I say, okay, Henrik, I want you to go into this room and come back out of the room and tell me what you see. And you go into the room, and you look around, and you come back out, and I said, well, I saw a bed, I saw some pictures on the wall, and the bed wasn't made, so it was a little messy, and the paint was the color blue for the walls, and there were wood floors, okay?
Yep.
And then I'd say, all right, but you didn't tell me about the sneakers in the corner, so... I'm going to say you just didn't observe anything in there. You know, so you came back and you didn't notice the sneakers in the corner, but you saw everything else.
Right.
So that, you know, that's what an embedded target does. And the researchers, especially in the old days when they used to score those as a miss, they just didn't understand they didn't understand the remote viewing phenomenon. But, you know, what would you do to somebody who then said, well, I don't believe you actually went and looked in that room because you didn't notice the sneakers in the corner, when in fact you know you went into the room and you described all the major stuff. So the thing is, what we use as targets, we don't allow embedded targets, which are small little things like a shoelace that's embedded within a large thing. Because if the shoelace was the target in Sydney, Australia, you'd have the viewer go in there and the viewer is going to notice the opera house. And they're going to go there because of that shoelace. But once they get there, they're not going to look at the shoelace. They're going to look at the opera house, the coast. They're going to look at the big things.
The big picture,
The big picture, because they're going to assume the big things are what you want them to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then you come back out and say, I'm going to score this as a total miss and throw out your data. You collected over, you know, a long period of time with all that training and everything like that because you didn't notice a damn shoelace.
Now,
you get...
Yeah,
That's the nature of this remote viewing phenomenon, which is why the scholars who studied remote viewing early on made so many brilliant things, many brilliant discoveries, but they also made some bad errors because they didn't understand the remote viewing phenomenon itself.
Right, right. And of course, in this case, the case we're talking about now, no one actually knew the target because we're looking into the future. So we'll get into this here in more detail in the next segment, Courtney. We're going to take a little break here at this point. Let's give out your website again then, farsight.org.
Yeah.
And on there, there's tons of stuff.
www.farsight.org, and that's spelled F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T. And it's .org because we're a nonprofit.
really good. And of course, as you've mentioned a couple of times, there's DVDs, a good place for people to start. And everything is right on there through Amazon and everything else. Tell us about your books as well, Courtney, also.
Well, the book is the book that I've written about the... I've written a number of books about remote viewing, but the science book, which is Remote Viewing, The Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception, most people get it through Amazon. It's sold in a variety of places, but most people just get it online through Amazon. But we have links for it, again, on our homepage at farsight.org. And it's the only science book of its kind that explains the science of remote viewing as it is done using these military or military-derived procedures. So it's really the place you want to go if you're a reader. If you're not a reader, or if you like the visual presentation better, which a lot of people do, and I'm not knocking it, it's just you get a lot out of that visual moving picture presentation
sure.
type
yeah.
of
yeah.
methodology. Then it's the DVD, the Farsight Experiments. That's where you want to start because that'll bring you up to speed as well. But and also on the website for the Farsight Institute, there's also a link, and that link is right under the picture of the DVD cover, the Farsight Experiments, which is right on the homepage. And the link says, latest peer-reviewed published research, remote viewing the future. And that, if you click on that banner, you'll get the PDF of the article that just recently came out. And called Remote Viewing the Future with a Tasking Temporal Outbounder. And that was a peer-reviewed article in a leading scientific journal called the Journal of Scientific Exploration. And it describes the experiment that was used, the data collection and everything that was used for the Multiple Universes project. So, and that's free. And that's if you like reading science articles, that's a good place to get it.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. Good stuff, Courtney. Again, then the book Remote Viewing, The Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception, and the DVD is simply called The Farsight Experiments, and the website farsight.org. Stay with us, Courtney. We'll be right back with more after a short break here. continue in the second hour as we do in our member section with Courtney Brown, this time to discuss possible timelines for 2013 and beyond. He specifically talks about two possible scenarios and what will determine which one will be. Courtney shares more data from the Farsight Institute revealing a meteor impact event in one possible timeline. With the shutting down of manned space programs, underground digging, warnings of solar storms and global debt crisis, does the government and the elite know something that most of the rest don't? We talk about what will happen if these events do occur. Courtney explains what kind of events could impact other realities. This is a very interesting second hour that you shouldn't miss. Sign up for a membership and get full access to all our archives and listen to this continuation or any of our previous programs. We have a fascinating radio going back to 2006, video material, and much more for you there as well. I hope you consider if you're not yet a member. All the information you need to know is available on redicecreations.com. Next up on Red Ice Radio, Birgitta Jons Dotter, Kevin Annette, Jan Irving, Duncan Wordley, Joseph Atwill and Fritz Heed, Joseph Farrell, Linda Moulton Howe, and many, many more. Please go to our radio archive to see our full list of upcoming guests. Now, stay with us for the second hour together with Courtney Brown. This is coming right up.